Final seconds of the game. A chance to score, and the chance has gone begging. If your business's commerce platform keeps missing the target on golden opportunities, get the MVP you deserve. Get Shopify. Shopify is the commerce platform revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. Whether you're a garage entrepreneur or IPO ready, Shopify is the only tool that you need to start, run, and grow your business without the struggle. Shopify puts you in control of every sales channel. So whether you're selling signed football boots from Shopify's in-person POS system or you're vending vintage shirts on Shopify's all-in-one e-commerce platform, you are covered. And once you've reached your audience, Shopify has the internet's best converting checkout to help you turn them from browsers to buyers. What I love about Shopify is how, no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. And Shopify is truly a global force, powering Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across over 170 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. This is Possibility, powered by Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ranks, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ranks to take your business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/ranks.
Looking for a fun way to win 25 times your money this football and basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection for a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's as easy as that. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Ready to test your skills? Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/play100 and use code PLAY100. That's code PLAY100 at prizepicks.com/play100 for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks, daily fantasy sports made easy.
Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favourite football podcast back for another week. And today, we're going to be revisiting an old favourite. We're going to be sacking or saving Europe's under fire managers. It's been a staple of the Ranks calendar since the BR days. So we're bringing it back to take a look at five of the names already under pressure this season. My name is Jack Collins, and I'll be your host today. And joining me, it's our transfer guru, Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
I'm good, mate. Yeah, well, I say I'm good. I didn't have the greatest Monday night, and neither did you. We shared a half-time beer at Fulham 0, Chelsea 2. If you listen to the Patreon, I do believe that I said on there, like, how badly can this night go? Well, if everything goes wrong, then we'll lose 2-0. And if everything goes right, we'll probably win 1-0. Everything and more went wrong, really, and we did lose 2-0. I half blame Domino's Pizza for sticking that stupid sign outside the ground. And look, I am a stalwart fan of Domino's Pizza. I've been there since the early days. I used to play for Domino's Pizza. Used to run around I used to have a little red Fiesta and deliver the pizzas. I've eaten the pizzas for a long time. I can officially confirm I'm now on strike. I will not be eating Domino's Pizza for the whole month of October. Hitting back at them for that stupid thing that motivated Chelsea. But mate, we didn't deserve to win. Chelsea, Actually, were made to kind of look good by
good
us.
First half, I thought.
But they did play well. They did play well. Cole Palmer is a very, very good footballer. Mudryk actually played pretty well, to be fair. And yeah, they had some nice interpassing in midfield and stuff, which I can't not like. I came away from the game like, and I obviously like as a Fulham fan, don't like Chelsea because of the rivalry, but there was no resentment towards them for winning that game. I had no problems with Chelsea giving it the big one and saying 2-0 in your cup final and stuff like that, because it kind of was. Yeah, that's where I'm at.
So it was a sad evening, but yeah. It was not a game we deserved to win, and Chelsea fully deserved their 3 points. I thought
we had a nice beer, didn't we, mate?
Yeah, exactly. I thought the Enzo and Caicedo were excellent in the middle, really, you know, ran rings around the Fulham midfield, and that's not something that happens all that often with Reid and Polina in there. So
really,
yeah, credit to Chelsea, credit to Pochettino. It really did look good for them for the first time in a while. It's back-to-back wins for Chelsea. They win at Burnley at the weekend. That's 3 on the spin.
Manager of the month, Poch will be on for soon, mate.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Before we get into today's episode, I think we just want to have a little look back at what we talked about last week, because in the first episode last week, we talked about ranking the league leaders. We talked about the fact that City had gone unbeaten. We talked about the fact that Bayern Munich looked, you know, not great, but on good form. That Barcelona was starting to cook. We talked about the fact that Al Ittihad were top of the league. We talked about the fact that Brest had a really good start to the season. It's not gone well for a lot of these teams. We're going to work through them, you know, 1-10 very quickly, just to kind of look at it. But, you know, we talked about City. They lost 2 in a row. Obviously, no Rodri in these two games. And they've been knocked out of the Carabao Cup by Newcastle, and then lost 2-1 to Wolverhampton Wanderers at the weekend. Now, they played okay, to be honest, against Wolves, and they were probably unlucky to be on the wrong side of this result. But it is funny how things can change so quickly. We're talking about potential unbeaten seasons for City and the fact that who was going to stop this squad? Well, the answer was that Korean guy, Wang Hee-chan.
Yeah, I mean, we did flag up last week. We said, look, City are top. They're 100% so far in all comps. You said, well, they are playing Newcastle. And I said, oh, yeah, fair point. And then they lost. Look, it turns out that that question about Rodri, is this where the floor would be, was 100% true. Like, that has been the floor exposed in this Manchester City team, largely because the players that would typically step into that role aren't around. So even if Kevin De Bruyne was coming in playing a bit deeper, he's injured at the moment. Bernardo wasn't around to come in and play it. Even John Stones not available to come in and play it. So
it's a bit of as much as they're not necessarily like for like tactical replacements, Stones perhaps
they get
accepted,
it.
There is a little bit of leadership in there that I don't
leadership.
Think was obvious from the replacements that went in there. Kovacic is obviously a very experienced player, but he's new to this City side. Mateus, yeah. New to this City side. Calvin Phillips played very little
Doesn't
football.
Play.
So actually it's throwing a lot of people in at the deep end very quickly. When Rodri's there, it's like having a guiding light to guide you. Whereas opposed to when this happened at the weekend, it felt like City were just a little bit lost in the middle, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, I did a video this the other day for someone, and I said, you know, this is a very purpose-built system. And with all those players missing and these new ones having to come in, it's not fit for purpose because they're not entwined in it. They don't have that City nous yet to understand and make it function at 100%. So look, I mean, City will fix this problem, but they were two big away matches in the course of their season and they came out of it second best both times. They now have two more away matches coming. One of them Rodri will be available for. But that game at the weekend against Arsenal, definitely a tasty one. So I do look forward to that one because suddenly the Premier League has been blown open a little bit for the first time. And it looks like at least we've got the possibility of a title battle between them and Liverpool or Arsenal or whoever. Which when we were talking about the league leaders last week, we were basically ruling out.
Yeah, absolutely. It didn't feel like it, and now it does. And, you know, throw Spurs in there as well. Ange Postecoglou, Spurs keep rolling along, even if they were given a little bit of help this weekend. I want to go quickly to Inter, who we had at second. They won 4-0 away at Salernitana, but there was a bit of a caveat, I suppose, attached to this. Now, obviously, if you win 4-0, you win 4-0. I'm not trying to take anything away from Inter. But Lautaro Martinez was originally left on the bench in this game. And Inter didn't score. So he was introduced in the second half and he scored 4 goals in 30 minutes. Yeah. The first substitute ever in Serie A to score four goals, which is an incredibly impressive record. It was a brilliant, brilliant performance off the bench. He clearly didn't like being left on the bench. He's like, you're not going to do that again. That's enough. I'm starting every game. That's how this is going to work. But they did sort of toil a little bit until he came on. Alexis Sanchez started in his stead alongside Marcus Thuram, and it just didn't really go to plan. But I mean, when you have a player of Lautaro's quality and potentially the most informed player in the world right now, you have that ability to turn games around, and they were able to rotate ahead of the Champions League, which this week, which is something that Inzaghi talked about and trying to keep players fresh, which we didn't see in their game, their first Champions League game against Real Sociedad.
No, but even, you know, on top of that, which at the time I didn't find funny, but looking back now I did. Obviously, the episode came out last Wednesday, and that night Inter went and lost 2-1 to Sassuolo. So I was like looking at it, I was like, oh my goodness. Like, we've literally put this episode out. Man City have lost. Inter Milan have lost. Like, is this the worst episode we ever done? And I actually did text you at the time. Like, no, everything was fine when we put this episode out. We're good. I was like, okay. And then the closer we've got, I'm glad we're addressing it right now, because this is the beauty of football, right? Like, there, all these things a week ago were not cut and dry or anything like that, but we had a pretty clear, defined opinion about how things were going to turn out. And in just the space of a week, we're forced to think a little bit differently. So that just keeps you on your toes if you're doing really well. If you're doing badly at the moment, like our Fulham, it gives you a bit of hope that only takes two matches or 1 week to completely transform things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, it goes to Barcelona next. And they, on the night we recorded on the Tuesday, came out on the Wednesday. They drew 2-2 with Mallorca. They have since ceded their spot at the top of La Liga, first to Girona, and then obviously at the weekend when Real Madrid beat Girona, they went top of the table. Yeah. So Real Madrid are now top of La Liga, and it just keeps rolling, doesn't it? Because Bayern drew against RB Leipzig and was superseded at the top of the table by Bayer Leverkusen, who are absolutely sensational right now. PSV held the fort down. That was fine. They've done us proud. Sporting were fine. They won 3-2. It wasn't necessarily the simplest task, I think, in the entire world, but they got the job done. But Al Ittihad, they drew, and they've been superseded at the top of the table by Al Hilal. Brest drew. They've been superseded at the top of the table by Monaco. Botafogo drew against Goya, and they have kept their place at the top of the table. Okay, they have a very big cushion. But it's not been, that's four games without a win now for Botafogo.
Oh, wow. So
things aren't as simple as they look there. And Cincinnati have clinched the supporters' shield and won their game. So shouts out to Cincy holding things down at the top of the at the bottom of the table, but at the top of the table in MLS. So yeah, I mean, it was just something I thought we'd address because it was lots of fun.
Yeah. I mean, that's a fun refresh of where we're at in the season, and I'm actually excited that that's how things can quickly change. And I think that everybody, as I say, should be buoyed by this little change of events over the past week and how quickly things can change, especially in these early weeks of a season when things are going well or badly, and quickly, very quickly, things transform.
Well, I think this is it also. You know, we're looking, you know, mostly, I'd say, at Europe's top five leagues, but you look at then and extend that to maybe the seven, and then we look at different places around the world. But at the moment, we thought that City was the most cut and dry of all of the leagues. It probably still is. When Rodri's back, I still think they are probably the best team in the world. But they are only 1 point ahead of Tottenham and Arsenal in the Premier League right now. We've got, it looks like, a two-way title race starting to form in Serie A between the two Milan clubs, which is incredibly exciting in itself. Although Napoli seem to have righted the ship as well a little bit, which is interesting. We can see that in Germany, the Leverkusen are going to make a tilt at this. And to be honest, there was a moment this weekend where Dortmund went top of the table, despite the fact that they've had a rough start to the season. Their Friday night win sent them briefly top of the Bundesliga. So things are definitely not finished over there. And Leipzig will be that conversation. We've seen PSV and Feyenoord. Now we're going to talk about Ajax in this episode, but PSV and Feyenoord look set to duke it out at the top of the Eredivisie. It looks like we have a race, a big race between the big two at the very least in La Liga, but also the fact that Atleti are now 4 points behind, but with a game in hand on Barcelona in second. And you're like, okay, cool. Atleti win that, and suddenly we're back on with the big three in Spain as well. We're seeing Monaco at the top of the table, PSG dropping points at the moment. Now, I don't think Brest are going to win the title, but Nice look right amongst it this season. Monaco have this really young, exciting team. PSG do not look cohesive yet. I still think this is going to be the best PSG team we've seen in a while. But right now, they're just dropping off the pace a little bit. And the fact that Benfica beat Porto in the Clásico, them, Sporting and Porto separated by just a couple of points at the top of the Primeira table, it looks like we could have title races almost everywhere. I know it's early to be calling that kind of thing. But considering that there were a lot of runaway leaders across Europe last year, it does originally look now that it's starting to set up for a really interesting season.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, and I think this is what we want. It's a hard one to gauge because when title races are so open, it's hard to tell whether the quality of the league as a whole have improved or actually the quality is not as good as it was. But I mean, I just want competitiveness, really. As long as the levels aren't too low, I'm all there for competitiveness. And, you know, it's boring if you're watching all the leagues just turn out to be the same old winners. Even if the typical clubs do end up getting over the line, you want them to have to fight for that spot. And it looks like, at the moment, as you say, PSG, who would just be nailed onto in that league, they're going to have to fight back from here. Bayern Munich, they've got a fight on their hands. And that's what we want to see. Like, absolutely bang up for this.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we will leave the first part there. After the break, we're going to be looking at Europe's under-fire managers and the decisions we would make if we were their sporting directors. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Ranks FC. It's time for us to get into our main segment and talk about some of the managers who find themselves under pressure. We're going to take this in, well, we're going to take a stroke each, Dean, but I'm going to start us off at number five, where I've put José Mourinho of Roma. Now, a win over Frosinone at the Olimpico at the weekend has eased the pressure around José Mourinho a little bit, but he's still getting a bit fiery in his third season at the helm at Roma. Look, there's been a lot of criticism already so far. This has been the worst ever start to a Mourinho season as manager, which is not really what Roma fans, I think, wanted to see after they won the Conference League two seasons ago. They got to the Europa League final last year. It felt like, you know, there was a build sort of happening with Roma, that they were moving in the right direction. But the start has not been great. They are 13th. They failed to win any of their first three league games. They got a massive 7-0 win against Empoli and they won against Frosinone at the weekend. But they also dropped points to Torino and they were battered 4-1 by Genoa, who are newly promoted, and really took them apart. And there was starting to be some criticism around it. And I thought it was an interesting one just in terms of how Mourinho dealt with it. And he spoke ahead of the game on Sunday, so after the 4-1 loss to Genoa, and he was asked if he was the problem, basically, which is not necessarily the kind of thing I would ask José Mourinho, because you're going to get a fiery answer. He basically said, "I don't read the papers, I don't listen to the radio, I don't watch the TV, but I have friends, I have players, I have assistants, I have people who, even if I don't want to know, inform me of things. I won't accept it. It's not true. I'm not the problem. In football and in life too, there are multiple factors. It's the same when you win. You can't say one person is responsible for it. We all are. Lots of little things are at play in a football club, a business, a political structure, an educational structure. And I know because I've worked in one. It's always multiple factors." I completely agree with him here. Although I would say that when things have been won in the past, José Mourinho has very much been like, "It's all me. It's all me." And maybe it's a little bit tricky to come back and be like, "No, you can't say that when you win. I would never do that."
Yeah, exactly. Look, I mean, in terms of like Roma believing in Mourinho, I mean, I'm sure that has wavered a bit, but the stadium's still full. And like, that's been the case for most of his time at the club so far. So that's good. I mean, Mourinho says that he turned down the craziest offer of work
in managerial history. Yeah.
Yeah, so €30 million a season after tax to go to Al Hilal was the offer. And his reward for turning down such lucrative sums is like this horrendous start to a season with Roma and being told that he's the problem at their club. Now, I'm not saying he is the problem, but like, there is going to be this narrative about him during year three of a club spell. It's just something that was bound to come up, and he's got to now prove himself and show that that's not a real thing. There have definitely been fans questioning the team. I'm not sure whether they were necessarily questioning him, but as you say, journalists have definitely questioned him recently, but the fans have continued to show up. And they do always back their team. Like you see, like Lukaku, when he joined Roma, for example, like they're unveiling like a loan signing and they are like welcoming him like one of their own, like gets his ridiculous welcome into the stadium, like anything you've ever seen for a loan signing ever. But this is just the way they are about their football over there. What did I say when he took the job? That he wouldn't get to Christmas or something like that? I had no faith in Mourinho managing to stay calm enough, I think, was basically my main concern. I felt he's too emotional, and when pressure gets to him, he has these outbursts. He blames everyone but himself when things get tough, and I thought that's what he was coming through. But when he starts a job, he comes in and he has this new life about him. He's very calm. He's very he's got a load of narratives that he's built up in his head that he can just come up with when he's asked off the cuff. But it all wears off by the time you get to this stage of his time at a club, and he starts to get frustrated. Even though he doesn't read perhaps the papers, he's definitely very much aware of what's being read and said about him. And it gets to him every single time. It gets to him. This is a man that absolutely despises being questioned. And fair enough, like his ego is something that's been there since day one when he came into Chelsea and said, "I am the special one."
And to be fair, it's been well earned across multiple clubs.
100%. 100%. Look, I've interviewed Mourinho like in press conferences loads of times, one-on-one a few times. He's a pretty scary man. Like, I'm not going to lie. Like, he's given me short answers before. He's addressed me really nicely before. He's a very, very charming person. He's a very, very scary person. Like, being in his company is almost unlike anything I've ever experienced in football. So I imagine he's the same way in a football changing room or anything else around Roma right now. You want him to love you. You really want to be loved by Mourinho because you feel like 10 feet tall. If you ask a question to Mourinho and he comes back with a smile or a joke even, or is happy to answer your question, you walk out feeling like a god. If he puts you down, you feel like the smallest person in the world. And he just seems to always feel like the emperor. He feels like nothing can knock him down. Doesn't matter what has happened. He has 100% belief that it's not him that's the problem. It's everybody else. And it served him pretty well. I mean, yeah, he might have left jobs in his third season, but he's always bounced back with a decent job. And generally, the jobs have gone pretty well. There's been a couple that you could argue didn't, and he probably shouldn't have taken the jobs. But he can't resist it, can he? So can he now ride this wave at Roma? Well, in the short term, but also the long term, like, can he get to next season? I don't think we'll see him next season, but well, how
that's
long?
That's a different question, right? Because I mean, just kind of in the short term, Roma are in the midst of a massive injury crisis, especially in defence, right? Diego Llorente had to go off in the 20th minute or something against Frosinone. Smalling's already injured. Marash Kumbulla's already injured. Cristante basically had to fill back in at centre-back. And the fact that Renato Sanchez and a couple of others are already absent, obviously Matic left in the summer, they're a little bit short in them in midfield. So there's lots of different things having to kind of go on, and he's having to sort of juggle. He had to switch formations in the middle of a game recently. He really didn't like it. And he said after the Frosinone win, he said, "This was not the day to play a marvellous match. That would have been impossible. We did not have the freshness for it, neither physically or mentally." And I thought that was interesting. But his contract does run out at the end of this summer. So whether Roma extends that or not is a different question, I think. But right now, I think it would be foolish to get rid of Mourinho. But it is definitely something that is being, I wouldn't say considered amongst the Roma higher brass, but definitely something that's being questioned, especially in the media. And I was reading a brilliant article from Nicky Bandini, and basically it ended with this kind of idea that Mourinho had said that Serie A is the most tactical league in the world. there are teams in other leagues with great players and those great players can make a team great on their own. That's not the case in Italy. But if that isn't the case, then, you know, Nicky says the natural conclusion must be that it falls instead to each manager to build the structures that allow players to express their potential. Roma's early season struggles are not all down to Mourinho. And yet, having chosen to turn down the Saudi money and stay, it is still his job to fix them. And I thought that was a really nicely balanced finish to this, because I don't think Roma are going to get rid of Mourinho. There is already talk that next summer they are looking to Antonio Conte to come in and be his successor. Now, whether that's the right idea or not is a completely different question. And I have major reservations about that as a concept, to be completely honest with you.
Concept.
Well, yeah, exactly. But for now, I think the smart money and the smart move for Roma is to absolutely see this through and let Mourinho get to the end of the season, see where you are. And if it has turned around and gone well, then maybe you talk about extensions. Now, whether either party want that, I don't know. But actually, I think just to let this play out and actually have Mourinho with those 3 years and let him do that at the helm, even if he was to go, he then walks away in a kind of positive manner, right? There's no repercussions. It's not, oh, I love this club and I've been forced to remove myself from it. It's he walks away and it's all love. And it's the fact that it's still all love in the stadium at the moment, I think suggests that this bond between Mourinho and Roma is something that should probably be given the time to last until its natural end.
Cool. So you're saying do not sack this man?
Absolutely do not sack Mourinho, no.
Okay, great. That leads me on to the Premier League. And at number four, the manager we need to talk about is Erik ten Hag, who is definitely coming under the cosh a little bit at the moment. Man United suffering their worst start to a season in a long, long time. And this really isn't going well. They were lucky, to be honest, to only lose 4-3 to Bayern Munich. They're 10th in the Premier League right now. They've lost four of their seven games and alarmingly have only scored seven goals so far. And you're just looking at this from the weekend, particularly against Crystal Palace. You're like, what on earth are we watching here? Like, what on earth are we watching? Every time you start to believe United might have a platform to turn things around, it's taken away and they just fall in the deep end. It's an absolute mess. Like, the defeat to Crystal Palace is pretty much as bad as anything that's happened in the years since Alex Ferguson left. Like, the sort of team that they ended up with on the pitch, the sort of atmosphere that was around the club and around the stadium, just such a bad vibe around that club at the moment and around that first team. Erik ten Hag is not totally to blame. He's got injuries. He's been plagued by injuries. And, you know, particularly like left back, obviously a massive issue. Every time they look like they've fixed it, that guy ends up being injured. And now you're having to play a new signing there who's supposed to be your new central midfielder. And he starts playing there, obviously. And then Amrabat did well in the League Cup at left back, but then in the league was not the same player suddenly at left back, and he just wanted to be in the middle of the park. You could see that in Amrabat by the end of the second half. He just wanted to be in the middle, and he just looks much better, obviously, in the middle. But he wants to help the team. Everybody has good intentions around this football club, but Ten Hag's got to find a way to get this on an upwards trajectory. This was a really big month for United, and winning the first game against Palace was crucial, and such a convincing win seemed very promising. But now they're playing Galatasaray tonight. Obviously, as we're recording this, we don't know by the time this goes out how that's gone. If they've lost that game, then this should probably be a totally different conversation, and he might be under pressure. But then it's Brentford, Sheffield United, Copenhagen in the Champions League. And these games are supposed to be the ones that bring the feel-good factor back to Old Trafford, because after that, they've got a Manchester derby and then they've got Newcastle. The inconsistencies in this Man United setup make it hard to believe that they are likely to get anything from those two matches in particular. So they have to get something out of these batch of four games that they've got right now. And yeah, Ten Hag has to take the blame, but things have got so worrying that there are only a few people ahead of him in the sack race right now. Heckingbottom at Sheffield United seems to be the overwhelming favourite to actually lose his job and be the first Premier League manager to be gone. But after that, you're looking at like Gary O'Neill at Wolves and Sean Dyche. in all the bookies odds are basically those are the main three. But then Erik ten Hag is coming in. Erik ten Hag's odds have actually been slashed heavily over the course of the past couple of weeks. But is it totally his fault? I don't think it is, if I'm totally honest. But he has got this issue where he's having to be a disciplinarian. He's having to deal with a situation behind the scenes in terms of the ownership. And I do think that this situation with the Glazers makes it hard for anybody to come in and be successful in this environment. I genuinely do. And I don't want to make excuses for Ten Hag, because I don't think he is without fault here. But at the same time, I don't think that this is the time to sack Ten Hag. And look, I spoke to someone this morning because I knew we were doing this episode, obviously, just to get a steer on what the vibe was about him actually losing his job. And he's not going to lose his job. Like, they haven't lost patience with Ten Hag yet. Look, United came third last season. They won the League Cup. They got to an FA Cup final. Like, that all happened this year, right?
Yeah.
That hasn't dissipated. Like, we've all got short memories in football, and we're always looking at the here and now. But that was literally May, and we're now in October. So it's really not that long ago that Man United actually were looking back on a relatively successful season under Ten Hag and looking to build on that. You look at their transfer business, you're like, okay, Hoyland, they've got a nine. They finally got Amrabat through. They got Onana, like, that's an upgrade on De Gea. Okay, they got a couple of nice bits and pieces you didn't expect. Mount, Reguilón's there. Yep, they look like upgrades. Okay, they couldn't get rid of a few players they should have, but this squad seems like it should be better. And here they are in 10th place. But over the course of the season, if you stick with it, you'd like to believe that they will see this through. So yeah, my understanding of this is that Ten Hag is not imminently going to lose his job. They're not going to press the panic button here. But obviously, after a start to the season, when you've lost 4 of 7 games, alarm bells are ringing, because that is just a ridiculous situation to be in. And after the narratives that we've seen him come through, like, he thought he was going to have Greenwood available to him, and then that all changed. And then there was the Sancho situation he's had to deal with as well, and the Antony situation, and then Harry Maguire in the background, and the Onana problem, and all these other bits and pieces that have built up, and he's just been deflecting all these issues. It's been absolute chaos for Ten Hag to deal with. So I can't see that United are going to give themselves another problem which involves bringing in a new manager, because I don't know who would solve this. Where do you go? Do you go to Graham Potter? Do you go to Gareth Southgate? Do you go to Diego Simeone? Do you go to Sam Allen? I literally don't know where you go from here.
How many of those would actually take the job as well?
Exactly.
I can't see Simeone walking out of Atleti to join Manchester United. I just can't see it.
Yeah, who wants to be in that situation, mate? Like, not many people. So it's a very, very hard environment to manage in right now. And Ten Hag has to. He's got to turn it around. So I don't think, like, we're talking about obviously 5 managers under pressure here, and he absolutely deserves to now be in this conversation because he's managing one of the biggest clubs in the world and he's underachieving. But I don't think he's getting sacked just yet.
Yeah. I mean, this is Manchester United's worst ever start to a Premier League season, well, you know, since the league became the Premier League in 1992. So there is that to consider. If this was somebody else, if this was someone who hadn't had the successes of last year, would they be under real pressure as manager? I think the answer would be yes. And I think that some of the performances that United have put in this year have been incredibly substandard. But football is not something you can take out of context like that. Ten Hag did, you know, turn things around last season after a poor start. You know, it's easy to forget that there was talk of Erik 10 games, wasn't there? And there was talk of, you know, this man isn't going to make it to Christmas when Manchester United started and had that brutal loss to Brentford.
Yeah.
You know, there was talk that this bloke wasn't going to see Christmas. And suddenly, you know, they go on, they kick on, they win the League Cup, as you say, they finish in the top four. Everyone's like, right, the project's on course. We need to do the right things this summer. Some of those things have been achieved, others haven't. And that's fine. That's a mark of the trials and tribulations of this ownership struggle. The fact that, you know, the Glazers have had that impact on Manchester United, and the fact that it looked like they were going to sell and then didn't, and now it's all up in the air again. All of that impacts the club as a whole. And so until those behind the scenes issues are sorted out and addressed, there is going to be a level of grace, I suppose, that you give to any manager in terms of what they're doing. But I think that if United were to lose three of the next four games, we'd have to revisit this conversation, because there comes a point where, yes, not all of this, and it's a similar thing to Mourinho, right? We were talking about that, and I think that there's a difference with Mourinho in that he's in the last year of his contract. So if it was all to go wrong this year, you know, I don't think Roma are going to be relegated. And I don't think Manchester United are going to be relegated. But those two things are different, because Manchester United feel like they're, you know, halfway through a Ten Hag rebuild, whereas Roma seems to be getting to the end of their Mourinho project. And I kind of deal with that as a different thing. So I think that if United were to look at, you know, in 4 or 5 weeks' time, that they are still treading water / going backwards, then at some point, you know, you have to perform and get results as a Manchester United manager. That's expected of you. And the fact is that whilst United have had troubles and trials signing the right players and bringing in the right people, they have also still spent a lot of money. And those things cannot be ignored when someone is failing to get the best out of a squad. Now, again, you know, we talked about injuries at Roma. We'll talk about injuries here. United are absolutely under it with injuries right now. The treatment table is full to bursting. But you have to find solutions for those things. And in the same way that, you know, maybe a couple of weeks ago, if this was the exact same moment, I would have been talking about Pochettino here being like, okay, I understand it's a project. I understand that it's just begun. I understand that there's been a massive overhaul of 14 out and 14 in the summer. I understand that you're basically managing a development squad because there are no senior players in it. But at some point, you are a top manager and you're expected to find answers and solutions to the problems in front of you, even if you don't have all the tools you would hope for at your disposal. And I think we're getting to a similar point with Ten Hag.
Yeah, I mean, you're probably right.
I also wouldn't sack him for what it's worth. I just wanted to put it across there that you still have to get some answers.
He needs these players to all. He's never been able to put out his best 11 yet this season. The 11 he dreams of, and obviously Lisandro Martinez being out is going to be an ongoing problem. But if you've got Reguilón back in there, if you had Lisandro Martinez, if you had Amrabat, if you had Højlund up front, if he was able to build a connection between all of these little pieces, get the best out of Casemiro again. Like, this is all be going on in his head all the time. When am I actually going to unlock the actual version of this team that I want? I'm not sure he's ever going to get there, because there always seems to be a new problem that crops up at Man United. And the late, like, on top of all this, you've got the fact that Marcus Rashford is just like not producing. Like, he needs to improve his productivity, like, quickly in order to get this team firing, because 7 goals is not good enough in the league, and a lot of that comes upon his shoulders. Like, he is one of the
I thought you meant this season. I was like, that seems pretty good to begin with.
He's got to up things, because Man United, yeah, they don't have the goals coming, and he's got to step forward either with the assists or with the goals, and it will come. Him and Højlund are going to have to start converting in order to get United up the table.
Yeah, okay. All right, let's move onwards. And I'm going back to Rome. And I want to talk about Maurizio Sarri at Lazio.
Oh, nice.
Because after Lazio's strong end to last season, finishing second in Serie A, many people, including myself, would expect them to kick on this summer and challenge for the Scudetto. But it simply hasn't happened. Club currently 16th in the Serie A table. They're 2 places above the relegation zone, and they've won just 2 of their 7 league games so far. One was against Napoli, which is even weirder considering what's happened. And reports starting to suggest that there's dissonance starting to grow in the camp. Claudio Letito and Maurizio Sarri sort of hitting out at each other in the press at the moment. Obviously, there was a bit of a consternation in the summer when the president didn't listen to the coach's suggestions on the transfer market. And this slow start has only started to grow this problem a little bit. They've lost 4 times in their first 7 games in the league. And they required a 96th minute header from Ivan Provedel in the Champions League to salvage a 1-1 draw against Atletico. Now, that result looks okay on paper, right? Drawing with Atleti in the Champions League. Decent result. You can't really knock that. But the manner in which that game played out, I think, might be keeping Sarri's head a little bit above water here. So they're going to go on a retreat ahead of Saturday's game with Atalanta after the Champions League game, which happened before the Torino game, which they also won. But after they lost 2-0 to Milan at the weekend, Sarri came out in his press conference and said, "I started off with a list of players this summer who are my A choice, and I had a list that went all the way to Z. when some of the players who arrived were closer to the end of that list. And then Letito has hit back in the press saying, finishing second last season in our first half in San Siro proved there's no gap with the top teams and that our reinforcements are good. He also picked out Ravella and Castellanos as two of the best players on the park, who both obviously joined this summer. And he also said, in every club in the world, the signings are decided by the managers. And the large transfer market has nothing to do with what is happening. Unfortunately, individual errors and some unfortunate episodes are working against us. We need a cohesive spirit to get out of this moment, including from the manager. Which is not great. Not great when you're kind of reading things like this. Fans unhappy. Their team were booed off after the full-time whistle. The 1-1 draw with Monza, which was the game before the Milan game. And they were comprehensively outplayed in the second half at San Siro, which have not, I imagine, added much love to a concerned Laziale fan base. Sarri said after that Monza game, we were too passive. We handed the game to our opponents. We deserved the jeers. Clearly, many things aren't working well at the moment, but as we said before, the match is difficult to think we can just emerge from this negative moment quickly. We ought to do more, but we're struggling at the moment. We hope the Atletico game would help us kickstart the season, but playing after the Champions League game is tough for everyone because we are not used to it. That seems a bit weird. Lazio have been in European competition for most of the time that Sarri's been there, right? Yes, they haven't been in the Champions League, but they have been in the Europa League a couple of years, and they've sort of kicked around in European competitions. That shouldn't be too difficult. And I find it very strange that this is starting to play out now. Now, there is a thing that Lazio basically aren't known for sacking managers in any sort of trigger-happy way, right? And Sarri is on a big contract for another couple of years, so it would be an expensive decision. But I'd imagine, you know, they go to Glasgow to play Celtic at Celtic Park in the Champions League this week. And if that doesn't go to plan, I think there's going to be big, big question marks over what this looks like, especially for the fact that, you know, this group is Atleti, who they've drawn at home against, Celtic, who they're about to play. If they lose to Celtic, that might be the death knell for Lazio's Champions League campaign, because Feyenoord are in this group as well, and they're a very good side, as we know. So there's this other thing that hangs over everything, is that Igor Tudor is out of work. Now, he was Marseille boss last year, he parted ways in the summer, and he did such a good job with Verona. And he's sort of just sitting there in the background for any Italian club that is thinking about making a big manoeuvre. And I just wonder if things don't improve at Lazio pretty quickly, if they might just take that option because they'll be worried that someone else might if they don't.
Yeah, interesting. I don't know a lot personally about this situation, but I was reading an article on footballitalia.net, and I'll just read it out because I think it's the best way to do this. Sarri's €4 million a year contract expires in June 2025, but according to Corriere della Sport, his job will not be safe if the team continue to get disappointing results. Sarri was convinced he would have had more impact on Lazio's transfer decisions following Iglesias' exit last summer, but Letito's centralised decision-making, signing players Sarri didn't really fancy. I think, obviously, like Milinkovic-Savic, like when he left, that felt like a big moment, and that's a difficult player definitely to replace in like every sense. And yeah, I'm not surprised that this is the situation that we're now at. Like, whether it's totally Sarri's fault, if he's not getting his own say on who he wants to bring in and whether he's having to deal with players that he didn't really see fitting in with his setup, is a different matter, I guess. But yeah, seems like this one, mate, deserves to be 3 or higher because it seems like he could genuinely go soon.
Yeah, it's a really weird one because Milinkovic-Savic was really the only notable outgoing at Lazio this year. Now, obviously, that's a big one. SMS has been a key part of a lot of what Lazio have done for a long time. And not just his ability on the ball, but actually his stature and physical aspect meant that they were able to mix things up, go long occasionally, play the ball in at height and pace for him to bring down and move them up the field. Now, you wouldn't necessarily associate that with Maurizio Sarri's style of football, but it allowed Lazio to become less one-dimensional, I think, in the way that they played. Mm. You look at the players that have come in this summer. Now, obviously, they brought Daichi Kamada in on a free after his contract expired at Eintracht. Very, very good footballer, but not the same kind of player as Milinkovic-Savic, even if they play in similar kind of areas on the pitch. Kamada is much more of a technically gifted, sort of dribbly player in a way that SMS probably wasn't, you know, in terms of his long shot ability, in terms of his aerial ability. Yes, he could take people on and he was a good carrier of the ball. We talked about his kind of gliding style before in the same way that, Pogba did. But Kamada is much more of a kind of nimble, tricky manipulator of the ball. And they are not similar. But actually, I would say that you look at this and the squad has got stronger generally. Obviously, Tati Castellanos came in from New York City after a spell last year at Girona, which didn't go completely to plan, but I think he's a really good footballer. And I'm happy for Tati Castellanos. They brought in Rovella from Juventus, who I love. I think he's a wonderful player. They brought in Pellegrini, who comes in a left back. You know, Demisi left, so there was a little bit of a spot there and some openings to at least find competition. And Guendouzi came in from Marseille with an obligation to buy. For me, this squad looks stronger than it did last year. And the fact that they are struggling, yes, obviously they have to adapt to the lack of an SMS and you have to change your game. But Sarri has had a full pre-season. You know, SMS left on July the 12th. This is not he left on the final day and they'd spent the entire summer planning to utilise his talents in a certain way. Sarri has had a long time with this squad to try and get them to change it up and make things happen. Now, obviously not all of those players came in early. You know, Rovella, Pellegrini didn't come into mid-August. Kamada didn't come into the start of August. Castellanos came in on the same day that Milinkovic-Savic left. But generally, you're kind of looking at this and going, I'm not sure why this isn't quite clicking yet. And I'm intrigued to see if it does. I don't think that Lazio are going to sack Sarri. But I would suggest that of the managers we've discussed so far, he is the closest that I would be to being like, yeah, I'm not miles off pulling the trigger here.
Yeah, I think
that's... And I love Sarri, you know that.
Yeah, no, you do, yeah. And, you know, that's a fair assumption that he's not fully deserving to be under that much pressure, but the circumstances will dictate that he is, and that's going to be a really difficult decision if things continue to go negatively to stick by him. And that probably takes me on, to be honest, to number two and another situation from the Premier League. I think that this is a guy that the club need to stick by and want to stick by, but might not be able to for much longer. Sean Dyche is in trouble because Everton just cannot continue to underachieve. They are 16th in the league and basically seem reliant at the moment on Dominic Calvert-Lewin keeping them up. And this is a narrative that we've seen time and time again over the last few years with Everton having to rely on this guy's goals, and he's not available often enough to make sure that it's a certainty. They've had a really bad start to the season. Obviously, it began with Fulham going to Goodison and getting a surprising 1-0 win. Really, but then on the back of that, they were battered 4-0 by Everton. They lost against Wolves at home, three straight defeats, and then they were heading into this massive game against Sheffield United, which they managed not to lose. If they'd have lost that game against Sheffield United, I don't know if Dyche would still be in a job now, to be honest with you, but they got a draw against Sheffield United. And they started to turn a corner after that, and their defeat against Arsenal didn't matter too much because it's Arsenal, and then they get a couple of wins under their belts. Important
that's
one too
against away at Brentford, I think. Like, you know, that's not been an easy place to go for anybody.
Brentford
the last couple of seasons. Yes, Brentford are having an injury crisis. They're having a suspension crisis. Fine, but it's never been easy over the last 2 years in the Premier League to go to the GTEC and get results. And Everton went there and really played brilliantly. And suddenly it was like, oh, okay, maybe they've arrived. And then they back that up in the cup.
Yeah, a massive win at Villa Park, and they take loads of fans, and you're thinking, right, they have turned a corner. Here we go. They've got Luton at the weekend. Anyone that listens to our show on Patreon will know that I backed Everton in our game Pick 11. If you don't listen on Patreon, please do come over. It's a fun place to be. I backed him. I was like, Everton won't lose this game. No way can Everton lose this game. I'm putting 10 coins on an Everton win here. They lose 2-1 at home to Luton Town, and appalling result, right? Obviously, Luton have to win at some point in the season, but Everton shouldn't have allowed it to be on their patch in that moment when it looked like they'd turned a corner. The problem is Everton always, whenever they look like they've turned a corner, fail to continue with it. After this match that they've just lost against Luton Town, they have a very, very difficult moment because they play Bournemouth at the weekend. They play them on Saturday. This is one of the biggest matches, actually, in European football at the weekend because Bournemouth's manager, Iraola, is also under pressure. Whoever doesn't win this game...
Is it a sack off?
It's close to being one. It's close to being one. Because if Everton lose, then Sean Dyche has then got Liverpool away the week after, and Liverpool could absolutely batter them. So if Sean Dyche does not beat Bournemouth at home and then loses to Liverpool, I think his job actually is on the line. Now, Iraola, I don't think it's quite as definitive for him. Obviously, he's a new appointment. He's an appointment that you were very excited by. But so far, Iraola has 0 wins as Bournemouth manager. They've scored 5
in
goals.
In the league, they did beat Stoke in the cup.
Great. Ranks FC would beat Stoke in the cup. 4-0 they lost to Arsenal. That was look, you can lose to Arsenal. It's absolutely fine. The manner of the defeat was extremely alarming. It was as routine as you'll ever see. Bournemouth wouldn't expect to win that game, of course, but we could still be sat here today, I think, and Bournemouth wouldn't be scoring a goal in that game. And with them having a slow start to the season, it's come out in the Spanish media that there already worries about Areola's future at Bournemouth. Obviously, they took him from Rayo Vallecano. He got a 2-year contract. But there's already been reports that they're wondering if he's got the power to see through this relatively short contract, really. They said he's suffocating amid this start to his season. And his next 3 games, actually, are very key too. Bournemouth's next 3 fixtures, they've got that big one against Everton on Saturday. Don't miss it, people. Told you now, Everton v Bournemouth, the big match of this weekend. But yeah, Bournemouth have got Everton, Wolves and Burnley, 3 teams in and around them, right? So those are the games that actually are going to dictate where a club like Bournemouth are heading. Are they actually going down? Or are they actually fine and they're going to be able to keep their heads above water of that poor pack that's in and around them this season? Look, Jack, as I say, like, you were high on this guy, and I know he came in with a lot of hype about his style of play, and it's still early days to have managed to impose that, but they really haven't at all, and that is slightly worrying because other managers have managed to do it. It's not easy, but other managers, like, if you think, I don't know, say De Zerbi went into Brighton. Like, he managed to do it pretty fast. He managed to get everyone playing in his way. And I just think that at the moment, he's coming under pressure. I don't think he's going to be sacked. And if I have to say out of these two, then it's Sean Dyche for me that is prime
under
sacking material.
Yeah, he's under more pressure. I think there's something to be added for the fact that then the context of Bournemouth's season probably needs taking into account, because the 4-0 against Arsenal was the first time I've been like, ooh, that's bad. That felt uncomfortable. It felt so easy for Arsenal. It felt like one of those performances you're looking at and going, ugh, a bit like Fulham last night in many ways. But actually, when Bournemouth have played against teams who you'd expect to be more around where they are, they've done okay, right? They drew 1-1 with West Ham on the opening day of the season. And to be honest, they probably should have won that game. They lost 3-1 to Liverpool, fine. They lost 2-0 to Tottenham, who are absolutely flying, fine. They beat Swansea in the EFL Cup second round. They draw with Brentford away, as I just said about Everton. Not an easy place to go and get a result. And they were unlucky there as well, because Brentford scored a 95th-minute equaliser. They drew against Chelsea in a very, very boring game. Then they lost to Brighton, beat Stoke in the Cup, and lost to Arsenal. The teams they've lost to here are Arsenal, we're talking about as title contenders. Brighton, who until the last weekend, you know, are probably the most exciting side in the division. Tottenham, who are up there right at the top of the table under Ange Postecoglou. And Liverpool, who you've put as your second favourites to win the Premier League this year. This is not as bad as it seems, I don't think. I don't think this is anything
no,
to
I don't
hugely worry
about.
If Fulham had lost of our first 7 games, we'd lost to Liverpool, Tottenham, Arsenal and Brighton, you'd kind of just be like, okay, fine. Like, those are reasonable results. And to have picked up, you'd hoped, obviously, I think, to pick up maybe a point against Chelsea when they were struggling at home, or at West Ham when in that first game of the season when you really came out really fast. fine. But these three games are crucial. We see what Bournemouth are actually like in these games against Everton, Wolves and Burnley. And the second two are both at home. And I will judge Iraola. And I was hot on him. And I have got a little bit more patience, perhaps, because I watched a lot of his Rayo Vallecano side. Yeah. But I think if he loses all three of these games, then he's smack bang in trouble. But I just don't think Bournemouth can do that.
Yeah, no, I think they want to stick by him, obviously. And that's why I led this segment on Sean Dyche rather than Iraola, because... yeah, he seems like an easy target. He seems like... like, I don't think he's managing an easy environment either, similar to Erik ten Hag. Like, it's a pretty poisonous place often these days, Goodison Park, because there's been so much going wrong in and around that team.
Also, I'm just not completely convinced that this squad is actually that good. And I am
I don't know that anyone would
shocked.
Do that good.
I'm actually still shocked that they sold Iwobi on the final day of the transfer window, who was one of the very few very bright sparks in that Everton side, I thought. So, yeah, confusing times at Everton, I think. And whilst this takeover looms as well, there's a lot of uncertainty surrounding the club. That's probably the only reason I wouldn't sack Dyche. With all of the uncertainty going on, with the 777 takeover being mooted, with the fact that they're under really, really heavy investigation as whether they're fit and proper owners after some of the other clubs that they have run into the ground, basically. And also the fact that there is this thing that if they don't take over, are Everton going to go bust? There's so much going on behind the scenes. And in a similar way, as you say to Ten Hag, I think maybe just having a steady hand on the tiller for the moment is probably the best thing that Everton could ask for.
Yeah, definitely. But look, if they get to be genuinely looking towards being in a fight to stay in this division, it'll go, because they cannot risk going down as they move into a new stadium. Like, it will be horrendous situation for them. And look, there's some teams down there, obviously, below them. Sheffield United, Burnley, Bournemouth and Luton are currently behind Everton. They've just got to stay ahead of that pack and they'll be right. Yeah. As soon as they're under threat, and they are under threat because they're only a point outside the relegation zone right now, then it's a nervous time for Sean Dyche. And to say, gets a battering at Liverpool, you know, the knives are out.
Well, I'm looking at my watch and it's telling me that it's Big Sam o'clock. Wow, didn't think that was coming this early in the season. Here we go. And right, let's go abroad one last time. And I would like to take you to Amsterdam, where Maurice Stijn is currently the head coach of AFC Ajax. He was appointed this summer as Ajax coach after guiding Sparta Rotterdam to the verge of Europe last season. But I think it's pretty safe to say that, well, it hasn't gone to plan. I was looking at the Ajax Supporters Association website, talking about the abandonment of the Clásico against Feyenoord, where they were 3-0 down, game resumed, they lost 4-0. And the headline said, "The club is in flames," describing the whole thing as a low point in an even bigger crisis. Ajax are 15th in the Eredivisie table. They have won one of five games and they are 1 point again above the relegation zone. They contrived to throw away a two-goal lead in the Europa League and then another lead against, at the time, managerless Marseille, who would have been in this discussion had they not already parted ways with their manager and appointed Gennaro Gattuso, which is incredibly funny, just so we're all aware. That's going to be a quiet night at the library. Friend of the pod, Mark Geschwind, who you've spoken about before, is a big Ajax fan, co-founder of EIF Soccer. He tweeted this weekend that, "I honestly hope that we lose in a game against Valvike, and I don't care. Stijn has to go. He is terrible." Well, he's got a point, because you have to go back to 1964-65. Johan Cruyff had just joined the Ajax youth team to find a worse start to the season. One win and two draws. They are 16 points adrift of PSV Eindhoven at the top of the table, although in their defence they have played two games fewer. It doesn't help matters that their great rivals Feyenoord are also unbeaten so far this season and have just absolutely hammered them at home in the Clásico. There was an Amsterdam paper called Het Parool, which said that the Ajax defending against Feyenoord was stuff you don't even see in the local leagues on Sunday mornings, and described Stijn as tactically laughable. Ajax then, after that game, fired director of football Sven Mislintat with immediate effect. Now, there'd been an investigation into some of his dealings with ex-club Stuttgart, who were also investigating him. And it all looks a bit dodgy, to be honest. But Ajax have said that it wasn't because of that. It was because they don't think that he was doing his job properly. Painful reports coming thick and fast, according to the supporters club. Unrest at the club, not only on the pitch, but also on the management side of things. This huge pressure, like Mislintat lost his job. He'd stormed into the training ground ahead of the Feyenoord game, shouting that it was D-Day and telling Stein that he could be sacked if Ajax lost. Instead, Mislintat lost his job, but the pressure on Stein remains. And he said it's naturally a very dark afternoon after that game. And speculation is absolutely rife as to who could replace him. Rafael van der Vaart came out and said that he wanted Louis van Gaal to take the job, but van Gaal has ruled himself out, saying his health had to take priority. The CEO, who's interim, like the whole club feels like it's absolutely up in smoke at the moment, said it's a difficult period. If it was only easy to flick a switch and turn things around. And on the TV, there was a pundit called Jaap Stallenberg who said it's chaos, complete chaos. They're struggling everywhere, on the field, off the field. They need a dictator, a strong leader to come and sort things out. Now, at the weekend, Ajax looked finally set to snap a six-game losing streak when they were beating Valwijk 3-2 in the final minutes before a collision between the Valwijk goalkeeper and Brian Brobbey meant the game was abandoned. We're yet to find out what will happen there or if they will just hold the result instead. But just wanted to keep an eye out. But I think one of the biggest red flags for me, Dean, is that after 30 minutes of the Clásico with Ajax 2-0 down, Stein substituted one of his new signings this summer, Anton Gai, who is a 20-year-old Danish defender signed from Viborg in the summer. When he did, he let Guy walk down the tunnel without even acknowledging him. He sort of stared into space on the bench, drinking from his water bottle. And that's not what you want to see. A manager alienating new signings, youngsters, letting them stew on their own after a bad performance in what was undoubtedly the biggest game of this 20-year-old lad's career. That is such bad vibes all round, right? You're looking at that and going, what you need here is a team that are pulling together, that are finding some unity in the chaos. And instead, he is making scapegoats of youngsters. He is pulling them off. He is going, you know, letting them stew in the dressing room on their own. The guy went straight down the tunnel, didn't speak to anyone. There was one of the assistant coaches came up and patted him on the back. And it just was horrible to watch. And I was like, that is, you know, a young man who has been thrown in at the deep end and then absolutely left to drown in the ire of these fans in the van. And as soon as, you know, you've gone, right, you're the problem, you're being substituted 20 minutes in, or 30 minutes in, and then just left him to his own devices. That is not management. That is absolutely finding scapegoats and keeping yourself ahead of water. And I really didn't like it. I will give a little bit of balance to the argument, right? Ajax were fully not great last year under Alfred Schreuder. And although they improved a bit under Johnny Heitinger, it's clear the club are in the middle of a major rebuild. This summer, they lost Dusan Tadic, Jurrien Timber, Davy Klaassen, Edson Álvarez, and Mohamed Kudus, which is a lot of ability, nous, and leadership to lose in one summer. And they lost further depth in the likes of Stekelenburg, who might not have played very much, but was clearly still a key figure in the dressing room as one of the old guard. They lost Calvin Bassey. They lost Mohamed Darami, who was expected to kind of step up and really be a star. And they lost Florian Grillitsch, who just never seemed to work. They haven't replaced these players brilliantly either, but it's still a squad more talented than they're currently showing, I think. And Stein seems to be exacerbating the problems rather than repairing them. And for me, this is the easiest one on this list. He has to go.
Oh, mate, he's got to go. Expectations are absolutely on the floor with this guy. They've got some nice players, like Forbes is one of those that you'd literally pay to see in the flesh. But this is a negative team playing among negative vibes in a manner that just doesn't fit at all with the traditions that are expected of Ajax. I've watched him a couple of times and live, and both times they get utterly exposed. That midfield is basically like a ghost midfield. It's horrendous. They haven't fixed that. The two different times I've watched him were about 4 weeks apart, and it was exactly the same problem. Getting battered by Feyenoord was probably actually expected, to be honest with you. That sums up where Ajax are. They're expecting to get battered by Feyenoord. Two wins so far, like, it's just not what you're expecting. And the big games, like, you've just got to be in them. And even the 3-3 with Marseille, like, it might not look like a bad result, but it's a result that got away from them.
Yeah, but also Marseille didn't have a manager at the time. You know,
Marseille didn't have a manager.
It's just absolute chaos. They have to be winning that game.
They should have been out of sight, and they just weren't. The Feyenoord one is, like, for fans, like, so hard to take. I mean, we saw, obviously, the scenes that followed that, which are not great, but that's what happens in a club like this. Like, they're used to winning. They're used to things being a certain way, and they can't handle sometimes, like, when things don't go their way. But it's more about the entire decision-making process that's, I think, got them to this point. Like, Stein, I spoke to Mark separately a week or so ago, just on the side, to ask him how he's feeling. He's not feeling too good, old Mark Geschwin, our old friend of the pod. Everybody, I think, at Ajax just wants Stein gone, and he's absolutely deserving of being ranked number one in this list this week.
I just think that you look at this Ajax squad, right, and it's so young. So young. And some of the players that have been brought in, I think, will, you know, interestingly this summer, or come back from loan, are youngsters. There's two goalkeepers come in. Ramage came in from Frankfurt, 22 years old. Gorter came back in from a loan at Aberdeen. He's 23. Sutolo came in from Zagreb, 23 years old, centre-back. Medic came in at centre-back, 25. The eldest, you know, players that were brought in, really, 25 years old. Borna Sosa at left-back, similar age. Avila came back in, sort of left-back, centre-back, 22, you know, from Argentina. They've brought in Guy from Viborg, we spoke about, 20 years old. They brought in Tahirovic from Roma, 20 years old. Silvano Voss was promoted from the youth setup into the senior team. Van der Boomen is the only senior signing that came in, and he's 28. Forbes came in, he's 19. You know, Tuber Apkorn came in, trying 27, but really hasn't hit the ground running whatsoever. And Mikhail Datse, who I was really excited about, you know, coming in from Metz, 22 years old. You need someone who is going to put their arm around these young players and coax them into, you know, learning what it's like to play this team. It is going to be difficult. But the behaviour, I think, of Stein towards some of these players and his, you know, unwillingness to start some of the players that were signed this summer because he had this falling out with Mislintat is going to damage these young players' careers. And I think that's the reason, more than anything. You know, this isn't out of any, you know, particular love for Ajax. I like them, great club, but I have no, you know, personal vested interest in how Ajax do. But you're looking at some of the most talented youngsters in the world here, and currently you have a manager completely and utterly mishandling the entire situation. And for me, that's it. That's the reason he's got to go. You've got to be trying to get the best out of these young players, not leave them as scapegoats while you scramble for your job.
Yeah, I've always had a soft spot for Ajax, obviously. They've just had such a big say in, like, footballing trends globally and producing footballing icons. Like, this is a truly historic club. Yeah. And whenever I've been to Amsterdam and been to Ajax games, like, it's a special feel about the place. I love going to that stadium. And yeah, it's the sort of club I want to at some point take my kids to. I feel it's somewhere you need to go to understand football heritage and see how football's supposed to be played. You want to go and watch young talent come through. Yeah, they might have to end up selling them all the time, but you want to see that, and you're not going to be seeing it while this guy's around. Like, they're a long, long way from the Ajax that is supposed to be known across the world, and they can't afford to let this go on.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Right. I think we're going to call it a day there on our main segment. But we've got a hot take after the break that we want to discuss. So stick with us. Welcome back to Ranks FC. It's time for our third and final segment. We've got a really good hot take from Sabre in Sydney today. So I want to get into it, and we can get into these discussions around this episode off.
Hey fellas, hope you're doing well there. This is Sabre from Sydney, and I've got a bit of a hot take on changing football as a whole, I reckon. I think football would be better served if the timekeeping followed an Australian rugby league style. So as opposed to having 90 minutes, 45 minute halves with extra time on each half, whenever there's an indiscretion, the referee will just simply stop the clock, and we get a bit of extra time altogether. So for free kicks, substitutions, and penalty checks, VAR checks, we stop the clock. Anything else that's quick, like throw-ins and whatnot, just keep the time going. Since also there'll be a lot less time wasting, We will reduce the overall time of the game to 80 minutes, 40-minute halves. Extend halftime a little bit so players can get a little bit more rest as they'll be running a lot more. But I think it makes a lot of sense. Thanks, boys. And thanks, Dean, for putting on your IT cap and getting this to work. Cheers.
There we go.
I think that's the first time anyone's ever thanked me for technological help, but no worries, Saber. Look, I'm with most of that. I'm not with the idea of 80-minute games. I'm happy with my 90 minutes.
I don't think you could play 90 minutes. I physically don't think you could handle it.
For who? Me, personally?
No, you could. It's a separate issue. I think that it would... The amount of time that a ball's in play is about 60 minutes, right?
Yeah, that's the tough part of this. Because I still like a game being 90 minutes. But I agree with the fact that of stopping the clock. Because I don't trust officials with their like timekeeping. The added time at the end of halves seems made up to me. Like, even at Fulham v Chelsea last night, I think we've got 5 minutes added time. And I was like, it doesn't seem plausible that it can only be 5 minutes from what I've just watched. Show me where you've got those 5 minutes from. Because the amount of substitutions we've had, the amount of time wasting that we've had, there has to be more than 5 minutes. Like, they could probably still be playing 4 hours later and Fulham wouldn't have scored in that game. So it didn't matter too much. But still, I just find the inconsistencies and the added time to be there. And I'd just like there to be, like we talked on the Patreon show on Monday about transparencies around VAR. Well, let's stretch it to this. Let's see an actual clock of when you're stopping time here. Like, that's what would really please me. And that's what would bring fairness to this too, because, you know, we see a Fergie time and we see, you know, big clubs getting favourable decisions when it comes to injury time, as well as like fouls and stuff like that, or penalties. But this would clear it all up. So I really, really like the idea. I was literally talking about this with my friend last night on the way back from Fulham, that we thought that stopping the clock would be a good idea. So I was really glad that this was the hot take that we got in today. I don't know exactly how you bring it in so that the clock can be stopped like by an official, and that gets mirrored on like TV and stuff and inside the stadium.
Well,
so I don't
do
know.
It quite happily in rugby, so I can't be that.
If they're going to say, but they can also get all their decisions right in rugby too through VAR, but we can't. So well, there would be some.
I'm sure there's plenty of rugby fans who would disagree with that.
Maybe, yeah. I've never watched it, but still, it's a really interesting concept that I do think is going to have to come into consideration now, considering we are getting some games have 4 or 5 minutes of added time at the end of the game and some games getting 11, 12.
Yeah, I actually am quite on board with the concept of maybe doing this, but you'd only put time off for things like substitutions and VAR checks, that kind of thing, where there's or injuries, right? So there's like a lengthy delay. It means that you don't completely lose the element of gamesmanship, which I think is important to the game. I've kind of maintained this throughout now. Sometimes it goes for you, sometimes it goes against you. But there is an element of gamesmanship that I think is quite crucial to the way that football works. And the idea of, you know, taking down the clock a little bit here and there is a really important tool for clubs who are punching upwards, I think, to hang on to results, etc. And those are the things that matter at the end of big games against, you know, the big clubs. If you are 1-0 up and you're just trying to take those extra few seconds, then obviously there has to be a kind of, you know, there has to be some sort of punishment if you overstep the mark there. And I'm not quite sure what that would be. But I think you'd only stop the clock. You wouldn't stop the clock for like goal kicks. You wouldn't stop the clock for...
No, you know, way. No, it's not free. NFL. We're not having like a corner, stop the game, let's have a chat about it. Right, it's gone out, goal kick, let's have a chat about it. Like, we're not having all that. Like, I'm not having a 3.5 hour long game.
It would only be for substitutions, injuries, VAR checks. I think those are the three things that you take time off for. But yep, if you could make that work, yeah, I think it would add something to the game. I've got to say, I'm with you in that. I think it would help with being able to just regulate this a whole lot more. So yeah, thank you so much to Sabre for sending that one in.
Yeah, top man.
An interesting discussion to be had at any given point, I think. So yeah, one we can all look at, and I'm sure that nothing will be done about. So we move onwards. Right, with that, I think it's probably time for us to call it a day, DJ. This is to say that we will be back later on this week with a Champions League takeaway episode, looking back at the best of all the Champions League action that will drop late Wednesday night, early Thursday morning, depending on where you are in the world. But for now, thank you all so much for listening. Thank you so much to our transfer guru, Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins, Knave of Hearts. This has been Ranks FC. Please do share this with any of your friends who you think might enjoy becoming a part of the Ranks squad. It really does help us to grow. And also, please leave us a review and a rating on wherever you take your podcasts, if you can and if you'd like to. It would be much appreciated over here at Ranks HQ. Take it easy, gang. We'll see you very shortly, later in the week. Peace. Final seconds of the game. A chance to score, and the chance has gone begging. If your business's commerce platform keeps missing the target on golden opportunities, get the MVP you deserve. Get Shopify. Shopify is the commerce platform revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. Whether you're a garage entrepreneur or IPO ready, Shopify is the only tool that you need to start, run, and grow your business without the struggle. Shopify puts you in control of every sales channel. So whether you're selling signed football boots from Shopify's in-person POS system or you're vending vintage shirts on Shopify's all-in-one e-commerce platform, you are covered. And once you've reached your audience, Shopify has the internet's best converting checkout to help you turn them from browsers to buyers. What I love about Shopify is how, no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. And Shopify is truly a global force, powering Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across over 170 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. This is Possibility, powered by Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ranks, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ranks to take your business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/ranks.